The next case is United States v. Payne. Government? Thank you. Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court, my name is Captain Zachary Gray. Together with Colonel Todd Simpson, we represent the appellant, Private Michael Haynes. Chief Judge, if I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. In United States v. Pierce, this court observed that double punishment would violate the most obvious fundamental notions of due process of law. In United States v. Gammons in 1999, this court, building on Pierce, recognized Article 15's twin roles, and in accordance with the accused role as both the gatekeeper with respect to admissibility, as well as the associated inviolate right to Pierce credit. And so for the last 20 years, this court, along with every other CCA to interpret United States v. Gammons, has allowed an accused to raise Pierce credit up to and including on appeal for the first time.
Now, of course, you got two issues here, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You got one issue is the legal issue. May he raise Pierce credit now? The other issue is, if he does he get it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So go ahead.
Turning to the first issue, however, what we would suggest that this court should stay the course for the following three reasons, which is, first, Gammons was clear both in what it did and what it said. Second, that this court reaffirmed Gammons in Bracey 4 years later. And third, that Gammons was well-reasoned in 1999. It was rooted in Article 15, and at the time it was necessary to protect those twin roles as gatekeeper and to avoid double punishment. And it remains well-reasoned today. And there's absolutely no reason for this court to abandon what has been 20 years of precedent that's been unanimously interpreted by this lower courts to allow the accused to raise for the first time on appeal. Turning briefly
to... So from your perspective, what did we mean when we said gatekeeper? What does that mean in the context of Pierce credit?
But, Your Honor, I believe that this court was looking back to the language of Article 15 that says specifically that when disciplinary punishment has been enforced may be shown by the accused upon trial. And then the second clause, which is credit, which is, and so shown shall be considered in determining the punishment. So with respect to the gatekeeper role, what this court established in Gammons was that the accused has the principal and plenary authority to decide whether or not an Article 15 or non-judicial punishment comes in to the fact finder at the trial. If they acquiesce, as they did in Gammons, apparently, that issue can indeed be waived. But when this court talked about waiver when dealing with Gammons, it was talking about waiver of the admissibility of an allegation of error with respect to the prosecution's use of the Article 15. And so in the briefs, there's significant conversation in the Army Court opinion. They note the language about waiver, but it misconstrues and it conflicts.
Well, but what took place at trial was something else. What took place at trial was, counsel, do you agree he gets X amount of credit? Yes, sir, three bags full. If that isn't waiver, what is it? I'm not talking about the technicalities of what he's waiving. Counsel agreed that he got X. If he's now complaining that he deserved X plus something, how on earth is that not waived?
So
at least as to X.
Your Honor, with respect to the credit that he specifically stated that he was entitled to, I would say if we were re-raising the other forms of credit, then that would be an affirmative waiver. In United States versus Gladue, this court looked at express affirmative, not waiver by operation of law, but knowing an intelligent waiver.
A waiver by operation of the mouth of the counsel.
Yes,
saying, yes, Your Honor, I agree. He gets X and no more.
Yeah, but that conversation and that dialogue is taking place on the heels of 20 years of precedent of every CCA having determined that the accused has the ability to raise credit at a subsequent time. And if the accused is true, if the court is going to give full effect and power...
Well, why on earth would defense counsel do that?
Well, there,
to, you know, okay, well, you know, I have this road to slog, but before I slog it, let me dig two or three big holes in it that I don't have to dig, but it'll be more fun if I can fall into them on the way to getting Pierce credit.
So Your Honor,
or the way to getting, what, you know, X plus Pierce credit.
Yes, Your Honor. We would agree that there are countervailing considerations that might mitigate against deciding to wait. However, Gammons was fundamentally built on the notion that Article 15 credit, Pierce credit, is fundamentally different from other kinds of credit because it can be inherently aggravating. That's essentially, in most instances, it is a prima facie extrajudicially established fact that the accused is a recidivist. Okay. You've already been caught and punished for this.
Kemp-Gray, on that point, it goes back to Judge Stuckey's concern, which seems to me, if this is something that, well, he has several places he can raise this. If he thinks he is so much, all this credit is due, he could raise it at the trial, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he could raise it with the convening authority, right? And as a practical matter, aren't those the two best opportunities to get the credit if it's going to be due? A military judge can look at, you can make the argument down at the trial, you can even make findings if he or she feels like, and then this issue is gone.
Yes, Your Honor, there are under certain circumstances.
I would say most, wouldn't you think that? Wouldn't you say most circumstances of Pierce credit? Where if you're the defense counsel and there's an opportunity for your client to get some more credit off the sentence, isn't that something you kind of want to get as soon as possible?
So, Your Honor, if myself as defense counsel understands that I will have the opportunity to raise something on appeal, and if we can avoid calling before the finder of fact, the fact that my client is a recidivist who has already been caught and punished for similar misconduct, I very well may opt to not include that. So in a judge-alone trial, there's a good reason. Now, the counter could be, well, Captain Gray, what about in a panel case?
What about when it gets to the convening authority?
To go to the convening authority. And with respect to the convening authority, as the government noted in their footnote, there's an open question with respect to whether the convening authority could even give said credit after the 2014 amendments to Article 60. But I also would suggest to the court that the accused can't be faulted for deciding that the senior commander over the commanders who issued both the Article 15 and the individual who referred these trial to court, that perhaps the accused is going to get a better shake from three Army Court judges on appeal.
Well, that's all well and good, but the question of the abstract question of whether he can raise it at CCA level is entirely different from the question of whether it's been waived.
Counsel, let me ask you a slightly different but perhaps related question. Are you agreeing that you get Pierce credit only if you're being punished at a court-martial for the same offense that you got into people, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what do you suppose the purpose was in including in the pretrial agreement the fact that the NJP addressed post-parole misconduct? I mean, wasn't it to cut this whole thing off by saying, it's not the same thing. This is not a Pierce credit case.
Yes, Your Honor. That was, although the Army Court did not reach the issue of whether these were, whether...
Well, but I mean, the snip of fact says what it said.
Yes, Your Honor. I want to briefly take a moment to note that the Army Court didn't actually reach the underlying issue, which goes to QP2. With respect to whether or not the review was sufficient. But
can't we just say there's a stipulation of fact that says it addressed post-referral misconduct, this isn't a Pierce credit case, and probably granted the bond?
Your Honor, the Army Court latched on to that language as well. The fact that the stipulation of fact references post-preferral misconduct.
Well, because if you're a trial counsel, right, and presumably the trial counsel had some input into the stipulation of fact, if they didn't actually draft the entire thing themselves, wouldn't
yes, Your
it have
Honor.
Been to cut off this entire colloquy late after the trial?
Your Honor, and to that extent, the stipulation of fact could have stated that the accused smoked marijuana between on this time, that the accused smoked marijuana at this time.
But it just says address post-preferral misconduct, which by definition is not the conduct for which he was being court-martialed.
Well, what we would point out is that there was also a sixth year analysis that
and
came
he
back.
And wasn't NJP for that.
That's correct, and there was not NJP for that.
So that isn't this reference.
If I must misunderstand the reference that you're citing to.
That the non-judicial punishment addressed post-preferral misconduct.
Yes, and okay. So, and what it goes on to do, Your Honor, is to identify the urinalysis, the receipt of the urinalysis results, as the post-trial misconduct. And that is a fundamental misunderstanding of what a urinalysis is. Our Article 112 alpha is not like state DUI laws, where it is per se DWI if you are driving and have a breath alcohol of 0.08. We do not criminalize having X nanograms of THC in your urine. What we criminalize is the use of marijuana. And so to the extent that the stipulation references post-preferral misconduct, all this court has to do is look to the underlying quote-unquote misconduct and note that the dates are from June the 14th through July the 14th, and they can see that that substantially overlaps with the dates from the charged offense.
But not completely. You got something here that you guys rarely, if ever, see, but guys like me have seen, and that's somebody who wants out, who joined the Army, hates the Army, will do anything to get out of the Army, including smoke copious amounts of dope every day until they kick him out of the Army.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's not what he's been court-martialed for. He wants out of the Army. Yeah, and I'll do anything. I'll toke away until they drag me out by my heels. So how do you answer Judge Ryan's objection?
Your Honor, 2 points. With respect to the fact that you pointed out it's not a substantial, or that there it doesn't entirely overlap, I would point out that the Army Court opinion didn't acknowledge the fact that these dates are charged not as discrete, finite dates from May 7th through June the 24th. They are charged as between on or about 7 May and 24 June. If you look to this court's cases, dealing with material variances and major change, and I believe United States versus Brown and Hunt, this court has interpreted on or about to allow for variances up to 3 weeks. And so when you build in that 3-week window on top of June the 14th, that literally takes you all the way through the date that he gave the urine specimen.
But doesn't this discussion right here, right now, demonstrate the problem when things are raised at the CCA level or at our level? This could have all been thrashed out, could all be part of the record if it was done at the court-martial. Instead, we're engaging in essentially a factual determination about what was meant by the non-judicial punishment and what dates it covered and so forth. Doesn't this show the very problem of doing it this way?
Well, Your Honor, not surprisingly, the defense's position would be that this isn't that complicated. So I'll see if I can explain this succinctly. You have a court-martial charge under Article 112 that says he used marijuana on diverse occasions between 7 May and 24 June. During the Providence inquiry, he told the judge he smoked marijuana every single day between those windows. So that means that between before June the 14th, that there were multiple marijuana uses that would have also fallen within that charged Article 15 window.
But the 15 was also for a failure to go.
Say again, Your Honor?
The 15 also covered a failure to go, did it not? So we don't know how it was for marijuana usage, the discipline, but it also was for a failure to go. So how do we know how to attribute what to what offense?
So, Your Honor, I think that this court can...
I have another question. Was the NJP punishment actually all executed, or was it put confinement?
Your Honor, he was placed in pretrial confinement after 20 days. So it wasn't entirely executed.
Okay, and they stipulated that it was post-referral. We have to take the stipulation on its face.
I agree. And if this court looks to the underlying substantive charge of the what purported to be post-referral misconduct, it's clear that what everybody was interpreting as post-referral was the receipt of the results, which took place on August the 3rd. The specimen was given on July the 24th. That was pre-referral. And the thing, it just doesn't make sense. Going back to
counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt. In your brief, you don't cite the rules for court-martial, and I'm just wondering, why doesn't 905E apply to this like it applies to any other kind of relief that you might want to get?
For two reasons, Your Honor. We believe that this falls kind of outside of the scope of 905 Echo and Hardy. One, because the 905 Echo specifically articulates defenses or objections, and that Pierce credit is inherently different. It falls outside of the rubric for 905E, but more importantly, because Article 15 not only coincides with 905, but is actually a superseding authority.
Wouldn't that reasoning also, though, apply to Article 13 credit?
Yes, Your Honor. However, when Article 15, by its own express language, makes the accused the gatekeeper and simultaneously says it shall be considered, and otherwise he shall get credit, then for 905 Echo to be interpreted as raise or waive would run flatly contradictory to Article 15 and the congressionally mandated authority of the accused as both the gatekeeper and to receive credit.
One can waive a statutory right every day.
Yes, Your Honor, and our position would be much like Ledoux and citing Lloyd and a long line of cases. If there is an express waiver, and there was no waive all waivables clause here.
No. There was. Do you agree he's entitled to X? Yes, sir.
I see I'm out of time, Chief Judge. May I answer the question?
Thank you, counsel.
Chief,
I'm sorry, Kevin.
I'm looking for your response to the Chief Judge here. Now, I'm trying to grasp what your response is to this issue of waiver. I don't know whether it was embedded in your response to Judge Sparks. Are you saying that with waiver it has to be knowing and intelligent? And so... in this instance, the individual thought, even if I say I agree with the specific calculations here in terms of sentence, I know, based on the precedence of CAF, that I've got a get-out-of-jail-free card in my back pocket. Therefore, there wasn't waiver because he was thinking this does not constitute waiver based on prior precedence of the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces. Is that what you were saying?
That is correct, Your Honor, and with only one small amendment, and that would be not just based on the precedent of this court, but on Article 15 itself, that Article 15 empowers the accused as the gatekeeper, and to read a waiver requirement into this would not only run contrary to this court's other precedent, but also would undermine Congress's expressly appointed role.
Chief Judge, let me ask counsel to save something for rebuttal. Here's what I'd like you to do, counsel, on rebuttal. You familiar with United States versus Inong, I-N-O-N-G?
I am, Your Honor.
Now, the reason why I ask is because in your response to Judge Maggs, you alluded to this. Inong was an Article 13 case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And pretty much the same arguments were made there that you're making here with regard to this Article 15 credit. And in Einong, didn't the court decide that, hey, look, this is something that's better resolved by the trial or by the trial judge and the convening authority, and if you don't raise it down there, you've waived it here. Isn't that what Einong decided? With respect to pretrial punishment credit?
Your Honor, would you like me to discuss that in rebuttal?
Yeah, that's my question.
Please address that. Mm-hmm.
Will do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Harris, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Williams, we represent the government. The court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because, factually speaking, this does not even belong within the realm of Pierce credit. Nevertheless, the legal conclusion is clear. This court told us in Gammons that when an appellant chooses not to raise the issue of Pierce credit before final action, it is waived. He is not entitled to ask for Pierce credit for the first time on appeal absent of collateral issues such as ineffective assistance of counsel. To the extent that this court disagrees with waiver, Pierce credit is simply inapplicable in this case based on its own facts.
Okay, is it the government's position that we can decide this thing without getting into Gammons?
Yes, Your Honor.
That we can decide this thing on narrower grounds without getting into the continuing validity of Gammons?
In this case, Your Honor, based on the facts itself, there is an affirmative waiver by the appellant. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but that would be by waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
That would be by waiver. If it isn't waived, then we have to jump into Gammons.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, you also just say that under Gammons, right, that the waiver is part and parcel of the gatekeeper function, right, which is they have the option to raise it to any sentencing authority, right, and if they don't, it's waived.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, that is what occurred in this case.
And so in terms of gatekeeper, it just means that the government can't introduce evidence to the NJP to say, look, what a bad person this is.
Correct, Your Honor. That is how the government reads Gammons, and that is also in line with the Gammons to say that the appellant has four ways to treat Pierce credit or NJP. He can ask for that sentencing in a 39A session before the convening authority or do nothing. But waiting until appeal to raise it for the very first time is not one of the ways delineated by Gammons as to how an appellant can raise the issue of Pierce credit.
Is it a Pierce credit case or is it?
It is not, Your Honor, because the misconduct was separate. As the appellant agreed in the stipulation of fact, he specifically agreed.
Okay, can't we just decide it on that and say, regardless of the abstract point with regard to Gammons, he gets nothing because he stipulated it away.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. He agreed in the stipulation of fact that there was misconduct subsequent to preferral. He also stated,
well, he agreed that the Article 15 went to that misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, there were two other charges that were completed.
Well, yeah, there's the failure to go and all that. He wasn't court-martialed for failing to go.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So, in other words, we could simply decide it on that basis and say whether or not, abstractly, he can raise it at this level, he gets nothing, so that's it.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's important to point out also, as the appellant argued, that you know the honor about and the diverse occasions could subsume this extra 3 weeks somewhere, it's important to look at the stipulation of fact and the facts that the nanogram levels were increasingly rising. So the test from June had an anagram level of, I believe, 33.
Well, that's because he wanted out of the Army, and he hated the Army, and he smoked dope every day until the Army kicked him out.
Yes, Your Honor. And he, in fact, admitted to that in the colloquy with the judge. So his nanogram levels were continuously rising up to 306 in the July test and up to 794 in the August test, again showing factually that this was a complete, separate, and distinct action for which he was punished in the NJP.
So, Captain Harris, based on the Chief Judge's question, is the government position that right out of the box the government would prevail? Would the government also prevail if you were to say, let's go to the very end of the process? let's say that we view all of the case law and the facts in this particular case in the light most favorable to appellant. Once we get down to what is in the record, that there's not enough there for us to decide that they marry up in such a way that credit should be, it's only 20 days, that it should be, this court should weigh in and say 20 days is appropriate. So you prevail both at the beginning of the process and if we jump down to the end of the process, the government prevails there as well.
I believe, if I understand your question, Your Honor, I believe yes. So our argument is, first, it was waived. The appellant waived it when he admitted to the judge, I'm only entitled to 107 days for pretrial credit and nothing further. However, that demonstrates why more of the granted issue one, why waiver should apply, because it's heavily factually dependent. So in this case, we have the luxury of the stipulation of fact and enough evidence where we can address the merits, even though the government's argument is that it would be waiver. But we may not have that in every case.
Wouldn't you start by saying this isn't a pure credit case, and two, even if it was, it's waived, and three, even if it isn't waived, there's nothing in the record for us to tell that he's not entitled to it?
Correct, Your Honor. If I go back one step, that would be correct, is he's not entitled to it. But I think this case also demonstrates in the bigger picture the interpretation of Gammons is important, because we have the luxury in this case of having the stipulation and having the facts. We may not have that in every case. And as this court stated in Bracey, if the appellant wants to introduce facts and obtain a ruling on the NJP versus the court-martial charges, the time to do that is at trial. And that is what the government is asking this court to identify again in line with Gammons, is that waiver applies unless you bring it to the person most eligible or the lowest, address at the lowest level. So the best place to address this issue would be before trial, before the fact finder, or before the convening authority, not just sitting back and waiting for the first time appeal when the government cannot appropriately respond and just bring it up for the first time without having the facts developed in the record. There's several policy reasons, again, why waiver should be the rule, but also why Gammons should be interpreted to show waiver. First of all, Gammons warned that the Pierce credit cannot be used as both a shield and a sword, and that appears to be what is happening in this case. The second thing that Gammons talked about is this case, the appellant's role, while recognizing the appellant's role as the gatekeeper, does not allow the appellant to misinform or mislead the court. So by waiting and not raising the issue and not developing the facts, especially in guilty plea cases where there usually is an underdeveloped record or not as many facts eligible, it precludes the government from making a fair comment on the matters reasonably raised by the appellant only on appeal.
But weren't those factors considered by this court in Bracey, these policy arguments? Weren't they part and parcel of it? And then in Bracey, we engaged in an analysis of it.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that if you look at it, I would just switch it. So the way the government is saying is it's waiver, but in this case, and to answer the second granted issue, there was at least enough in this case that the Army Court could make an analysis based on the facts. But that also highlights why waiver is important, because they are highly factually dependent, and we may not always have the luxury. So in Bracey, you're correct, Your Honor, the court did address the merits, because they potentially had enough facts in that case, but they also ended by saying the time to address it was at trial and not on appeal. And that's what the government is arguing should be upheld in this case as well.
Wasn't the language a little bit different there? It wasn't that. It says, quote, if appellant wanted to introduce facts to get the nonjudicial punishment credit, the time to do so was at trial, not an appeal, end quote. Couldn't that be viewed as the court essentially saying, hey, if appellant wanted to make an adequate record to ensure that before the convening authority or before the CCA or before the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces that he got credit, that was the time to do it at trial. Does that statement in the case really necessarily mean that if they wanted to get the credit, they had to do it then, as compared to if they wanted to develop the facts so that they would get credit later, that was the time to do it at the court?
Yes, Your Honor, I think if I understand the question, that could be two potential ways to read that case. And I think that's why clarification in this case is appropriate, to show that when Gammon said if an appellant does not bring it up, it's waiver, that this court could affirm that and say that waiver actually means waiver. And that would help to clarify any two potential readings off of the Bracey case, because it could be interpreted in both of those ways. In this case, the appellant, to address the second issue, the Army Court, even if it erred in finding waiver, and this court finds that waiver does not apply, the Army Court's review was complete, specifically on the stipulation of fact. He said and agreed, signed his name to a document, that this was misconduct, the NJP was for misconduct subsequent to referral. In fact, the government didn't even have the results of the fifth positive drug test when they preferred charges against him. He was represented by counsel when he received the Article 15. So because charges had been preferred on August 3rd, and then he received NJP on August 11th, he was already represented by counsel at that time. So a good defense counsel, if he had a client that said, look, I'm getting an Article 15, and he's like, look, these are for the same things, turn it down, make them take you to court, raise the issue. He did have a defense counsel who was very good and proactive at asking for Article 13 credit, asking for pretrial confinement credit. So we don't have a case here of ineffective assistance of counsel. We don't have a case of a defense counsel asleep at the wheel. We have an appellant saying he is not entitled to Pierce credit because he was not entitled to Pierce credit. He never suffered punishment under the NJP that was rendered. So in addition to the NJP being for different misconduct, assuming even it was for the same thing, he never even suffered punishment. He was given 45 days. He served 19 of those days before his spiraling out of control activities caused him to be placed in pretrial confinement. And of those 19 days, he missed 8 of the additional duties. So at best, at very best, he only served 11 days of the punishment for the NJP, which was completely separate from the trial or the charges for which he was court-martialed. By waiting and only now claiming his entitlement on appeal, appellant misinformed the judge when he agreed to how much credit he should receive. Pending further questions, this court should affirm the findings and sentence because he waived his right to request Pierce credit. And even without waiver, Pierce credit does not apply to the facts of this case.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Chief Judge Sparks, to return to your question.
I'm not the Chief Judge.
Oh, excuse me.
I wish he were.
Usually the first thing out of my mouth.
In fact, judging by my term, I'm way off.
Judge Sparks, to return to your question with respect to how this case relates with Enong, we agree it makes sense that this court would be consistent. But Enong, discussed waiver absent plain error. So in other words, it was a waiver, but what we meant is a forfeiture style analysis. And even under these facts, this would nevertheless be plain error. So, but there's a second reason, and this is why Pierce credit is so unique, is that unlike Article 13 credit, where there is no reason for you not to raise it earlier, right? It doesn't have the possibility of being inherently aggravating. And that's not the case with Pierce credit. And that's why Pierce credit is unique unto itself. And that's why we have this.
Tell me again why it's aggravating to raise it as soon as you can.
Well, Your Honor, so if it's before the same fact finder, and by virtue of the way that Pierce credit cases tend to come up, there tends to be one NJP offense, which is also on the court-martial charge sheet, and then another a series of other subsequent acts of misconduct. And what it tells the fact finder is that first, this individual has been already not just committed the misconduct, but was caught and was punished. And then, oh, look, the government says he still continued to commit misconduct. So it per se establishes the accused as a recidivist.
You say that's the case even if it's a military judge alone? That he, too, would be influenced by this?
Well, Your Honor, our position is that it's human nature, whether consciously or subconsciously, that this establishes that the accused, at least one echelon of the command.
But if you're looking for Pierce credit, counsel, the argument has got to be not that he's a recidivist, but it's the exact same thing.
Yes, Your Honor. And
so if you say, Your Honor, he's already been punished for this, he should get credited for what he was already punished for, how does that make him look like a recidivist?
Well, Your Honor, so that's...
As opposed to a duly punished, unduly punished.
I understand, Your Honor, but that's assuming that it comes in the first place. Right? What this court interpreted Article 15 and Congress to have done is to say, and non-judicial punishment will not be a bar under double jeopardy to subsequent court-martial for major offenses. However, the accused will remain the gatekeeper and decide if it comes in or not, and irrespective of whether it comes in or not, that he shouldn't get... that the accused should not be double punished, and therefore he should get that credit.
Go ahead.
So just in terms of how this plays out at the court-martial, you were talking about introducing the Pierce credit would be inherently aggravating.
It can be.
And we're also talking about the accused being the gatekeeper. So what about a setup where, for the sake of argument, military judge says, okay, here's your sentence, 90 days. And then the accused says, I'm exercising my gatekeeping responsibility. I've got this 20 days in my back pocket, military judge. I want this credited towards the 90 days. How then does this inherently aggravating argument work?
Well, so under those circumstances, I'm not sure that it inherently aggravates it, other than the fact that presumably we are still midstream sentencing, and although the accused has been, you said post-sentencing.
And at that point, doing it that way, the military judge can say, well, wait a minute, we need to really flesh this out and go through partly what you've been doing today, where we're trying to tease out the failure to go part, the your analysis dates, the scope of the charge. There, your concern about the inherently aggravating aspect of Pierce credit is done away with, isn't it?
But Your Honor, I would just call this court's attention to United States versus Meade, wherein the court held that Pierce credit will come off of the adjudged sentence. And when it comes to a guilty plea such as this, depending on whether or not the accused, quote-unquote, beats the deal, they may have a very good reason to then wait until the convening authority takes action, so that it comes off to ultimately be approved. And Chief Judge,
I have one last. I know he's over time. Yes, I do have one last question. I hate to keep beating up on you, but if you're at the counsel table, you and your client, and you make this argument to the client, you say, hey, look, we have a 20-day credit we can get 2 years from now on appeal. What do you think? And he's sitting there with a five-month sentence. Isn't he going to look at you like, wait a minute, I want to get out of here as soon as possible?
Your Honor, that under some circumstances, that would be the wise course of action.
I would say under every circumstance, that would be wise.
Under most, but as the dialogue, as our...
I mean, given the scenario, the hypothetical I just gave, under every scenario like that one, you have to agree that your client is going to be looking at you askance, don't you think?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the defense will take a Pyrrhic victory if that's all we can get. I would close, however, by suggesting that the Army Court's opinion is entirely ambiguous. They, on three separate occasions, expressly stated they did not reach the underlying issue, which is whether the accused was, in fact, double punished. To the extent they talked about it substantively, it was entirely ambiguous, confusing. And per this Court's precedent in Kosick, this Court should remand for reconsideration consistent with Gammon's. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted and court is in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.